see some of you'll show up.
Where you, Gar. Short answer for the question, right?
This is part of the Economic Democracy Conference. We'll be in this room the whole time. So if you're interested in that, you can. We have out around the edges and downstairs a flyer of all the Economic Democracy sessions. So if you want to see what's going on with this, you can check it out. My name is Kevin Zeis, and with Margaret Flowers, I co-direct this banner falling thing. It's OurEconomy.us. And among other projects, we have Popular Resistance, which is a website that focuses on the resistance movement. Popularresistance.org, I recommend it to you highly. People think that Occupy died and there's no resistance. If you look at this website, you'll be happily pleased to see that, in fact, there's a lot going on. So there is a really great deal going on. And then after Gar is done, we'll move this back to the center. There's some more websites on the corner that you can take down later. Gar Alperovitz is our speaker today, and we're talking about a pretty exciting topic. Everybody, you know, in this room is well aware that the system is what's broken. It's not one issue, it's multiple issues. We have a system that is dysfunctional, both in the economy and the government, unable to really provide what people need, protect the planet, and share the wealth fairly. And Gar is working on now going deeper into his already existing work. If you haven't read America Beyond Capitalism, I recommend it highly. And his most recent book, What Do We Do Now? Strategy book, also recommend that. But when did first America Beyond Capitalism come out?
2005.
When I read that book, it definitely opened my eyes up, and I've been working on these issues ever since. I was working on them a little bit before that, but that book, America Beyond Capitalism, really opened my eyes up and started things much more clearly for me. So I recommend that highly. Gar has been laying out the proof that economic democracy is happening. That's right now happening all over the country in so many ways. Literally 100 million plus people are involved in it in some way or the other, 135 million involved in co-ops, credit unions, all sorts of activities. We're developing new structures. His new work, which he's going to begin to talk about today, is developing a system, a new system. What kind of systems can we put in place to actually function? Because what we have right now is not functioning. So with that, I'll let Gar talk about the details. Gar Alperovitz. Thank you.
Kevin and Margaret are doing fantastic work. Check out that website. It's really awesome. And then, can they get the radio program on it?
Yeah, clearingthefogradio.org is our radio show. FOG stands for Forces of Greed. clearingthefogradio.org. We do an article each week based on it, and Truth Out every Wednesday.
And that, yeah, you know, I envy that time. It's fantastic stuff you guys write. And I produce all that stuff. Oh, there's two of them there. So I'm just going to assume that I'm not going to talk a lot about how you get from here to there. I mean, that was a little bit last night, and that's what the book is all about. And the precondition is that, so briefly, precondition is that the system's in an unusual crisis. The pain is driving a lot beyond the different awareness, the new consciousness. There are a lot of experiments working on companies, co-ops, land trusts, utilities, public utilities, local stuff, cities, 27 states investing directly in companies, mini-socialism, partial socialism. Somebody asked me about, we were talking about oil revenue, did I know any place where mineral rights and revenues were used directly for public services? And everybody thinks of Alaska. How many people know a state that uses vast oil directly socialized, not like the Alaska Corporation, to fund education?
Georgia?
Olivia?
You told me.
So.
Yeah.
Texas.
Texas.
Nobody knows about it. It's a socialist country. They will they have some. That's how they do it. It's in the book. I was amazed when I first discovered that, because they own land rights and offshore rights, and it's direct funded in education. So they're doing it. But anyway, if you look around, one of the things, if you look around the country, probably in your own area, and poke deep, nobody does the research, and there is a whole lot going on that is involved with democratizing ownership. But I'm not going to cover any of that. The book is a lot about why that's going. There's also a beginning debate, and a really important debate. What if you don't like corporate capitalism, you don't like state socialism, what the hell do you want? And if you don't know, what are you talking about? I mean, the question really is, all you radicals, What do you want? And a lot of people have been really airy-fairy about it and abstract and rhetoric and so forth. And so if someone honestly, and I'm from the Midwest, I'm from Racine, if my buddies that I went to high school with, some of them are conservative but very smart and very honorable, you know, guys who are, I'm thinking of one guy particularly, a religious guy, but very smart kid out of school, we're still friends, very conservative, he wants to know what I'm talking about. Really. I don't want any rhetoric. And I think that poses a question that we have to really grapple with, or we don't have an answer. There's a lot of work to do in terms of protesting, stopping, building alternatives. But ultimately, if you're talking about systemic change, we need an informed, serious dialogue to begin to really develop what that actually means. So that's what we're going to talk about, at least in this discussion. And I've been really pretty deep into it the last several years, but more and more now that I got this book on my back. Thank you. So the traditional argument is state socialism, Soviet Union style, was a system which concentrated power excessively in the hands of the state by not democratizing ownership, but socializing ownership, and it gave the bureaucrats and the elites and the power center, it gave the power base to them. And that the critique was made, there was a genuine critique made by the anarchists, there was a genuine critique made by some of the democratic socialists, and there was a really powerful, can we get a chair for Ellen? So Ellen Brown, you should go to her session, she's spectacular on the public banking. There's a critique made by the anarchists, a critique made by the democratic socialists. There was a really good critique made by conservatives. They said that thing is going to destroy liberty. And they were right. So, and the left didn't take seriously any of the critiques from the democratic socialists, the anarchists, or even the conservatives, or what we call libertarians now. So, and that's a problem that we didn't quite want to face. What do you do about that? State, if you give it to the state, what happens? Rosa Luxemburg and some of the others are playing around the edges of it. There's a sidebar debate historically, we could get into that, but that's the first question. So, if you don't like state socialism, what are you talking about? The current debate largely is focused on worker ownership, worker co-ops, and worker ownership of companies, firms. That's where the big action, Richard Wolff has been pushing that argument intensely. I'm for worker co-ops and worker ownership. But Rick and a guy named, both these guys are friends of mine, David Schweiker. David's has done a whole system where it's all based on worker ownership. Now, I acknowledge and support worker co-ops and worker ownership. But I want to tell you some of the problems with it so then we get into the discussion. Worker-owned companies in a capitalist market must compete. They have no choice. Because if their prices are lowered by somebody else, they will be destroyed. So they have to turn into the same practices in many ways that capitalist firms have to turn to, including destroying the environment if somebody else is beating them on costs. So a worker-owned company, though in many areas, we talk about which areas, I think it works, which areas it doesn't, introduces the notion of democratizing ownership. But it has problems, and they're not acknowledged. So, for instance, if you had worker-owned companies of, you know, the garbage workers get to own the garbage company, but the oil workers get to own the oil reserves, there are problems about inequality. So you got to face them. And secondly, now we go to, that's just the economics, now go to political economy. That is to say, you know, I really want to introduce this term because people don't quite think about this usually. People like me spend all their time worrying about it. But political economy thinking is about the institutional power relationships that come along with certain institutions. The institutional power relationships. So, for instance, if the oil workers, here's what David does. Rick doesn't develop the whole system. He just wants worker ownership of the service. But David does, and David's really smart. David does it this way. He says, yeah, I understand what you're talking about, but we'll pass a law and tax the oil workers for the redistributed profits. That way, now I'm going to get, there's a technicality here about ownership. We'll come back to how these guys structure ownership as opposed to management. But in any case, the idea is we'll pass a law and we'll take care of that problem. Huh? anybody who understands anything about political economic power and institutional power, you know that the power attends and goes along with the power base. Now, socialist culture or egalitarian ideas can moderate the laws you can pass. Good guys come to office, and they will do better. But David's whole scheme rests on the notion that you had a socialist revolution, and there's a consciousness there, and then you can do whatever you want to pass the laws to pick up the problems that come from the power base. And my contention is we can't allow ourselves to rest on that. Because if you let the oil workers have the oil, and let the garbage workers have the garbage, the oil workers are going to also have political power. So that's an inherent problem in worker ownership. So, and the second problem with it is, Okay, so take a
community. Would you put it on the whiteboard so we can all see it?
Yeah.
Or you can
hear me. Can you see it this better? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so this is a community. So, see, the worker ownership is there. These guys own companies. They're in competition, right? Competition means you've got to cut costs. And if you don't cut costs, you're dead. It isn't about good guys and bad guys. They won't be out of business. So, here's the community. Somebody over here is cutting costs. These guys have to, environmental regulation is expensive. We will die if we have to do that. So they've got to put in the community. They have to. And then the idea is, okay, we'll regulate them. That's liberalism. I come out of liberalism. We let the corporations, or in this case, the workers, own the stuff. And then you try to pass laws to regulate them. Now you can do, be careful about this. You can do a certain amount with a quote political movement. That's not an institution, that's a movement. Or a political party. You can do a certain amount. But in fact, the way it's really been done, including the United States, is you have political movements and political parties.
This is a short question.
Oh, great. Thank you. Political parties, Democrats and liberals. I was running for Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin, right? The leading environmentalist of his time. Gaylord was a labor lawyer, and he had support from unions, and that was the only way you could support the Democratic movement in party to actually do things. You needed a movement, you needed politics, you needed a party, but you needed an institutional base. And the way it was done all over the Western world is labor. Now, that doesn't mean they agreed on everything. There's always a fight between labor and environment. But you couldn't elect these guys, and that's what's happening now. The labor unions are essentially disintegrated down to 6% in the private sector. So the idea in the worker ownership system, like David's, I urge you to read the book. It's really a good book. He's really thought about it. But he hasn't thought about this part. You pass a law and it's this problem that these guys, and they'll all be fine. And my contention is that there's a power base associated with these institutional substructures that maybe it won't be all fine because these guys have different interests, even though they're good guys. So you can't assume just because they have good ideas and good politics that the institutional pressures they're under are going to lead to the kind of politics you want. Okay, so that's a number two on this. So you've got a problem with worker ownership. Now, there's a lot of areas where it doesn't really matter because it's small stuff. So we'll be able to talk about what you mean by small stuff later. So, and the third problem about the, and this is really critical. I have to do a little economics with you. Worker-owned companies, or any company, this is really important, but it's not simple, that faces diminishing returns from investment and scale. Let me say that. If you invest in lots of equipment, new equipment, and you can cut costs because you can buy robotic equipment, and that you get costs going down and down as you invest more and more in fancy equipment, if that pertains, and it doesn't always, there's a lot of companies where you can't do that, lots of small companies where it doesn't really matter, there's no fancy technology, everybody competes on the same ground. But if you have that, like really fancy computer systems, and you can get an edge by cutting costs, and you have to do this because it's a competitive system, that is worker-owned companies in a competitive system, then you will have to invest in the new technologies, because the next guy might do it. And that means you're going to have to drive down costs, and you must then expand sales and recovery. Now, that's really critical, because it means you've got to grow. And the whole system is designed to grow, because each guy in the system might invest in fancy technologies and beat you. And so the game is whether or not you like it, you're forced to grow. Even it's defensive. It can be also aggressive. I want more profits. So, and it isn't only technology. This is what happens with these systems. So that if so, look, that's not, I just talked about inequality, oil workers, garbage workers. Then I talked about environment, pollution of the community. Now I'm talking about growth. Systems of that kind, little small businesses that don't face it, they don't have to really grow, little companies. But if the next guy can invest in fancy equipment that will lower his cost, his unit costs, he will then have to do that because you might. And therefore, the whole system has to keep investing and growing and growing and growing competitively. So you got a growth system. And that has a problem in terms of lots of things, particularly in a global world that we need to talk about resource limits. That system ain't that what you want. And again, careful, David comes back. David doesn't really talk much about this. He assumes this problem away. Remember, I really respect David, so I'm criticizing him from a respectful point of view. That is really powerful. And if you don't object, and his answer would be, and Rick's answer too, Rick does the same, Rick, whoa. So we'll pass along. And I'm saying that's inadequate. That the institutional substructure will, in fact, subvert your law. So we've got to do better than that. Now, that's only one problem. And by the way, sidebar, it isn't only technology where you get diminishing returns from investment and scale, this economist language. You get it from the finance. If you've got access to more finance, the next guy can beat it with finance. You can do it with advertising. And most importantly, you do it with R&D. Companies that can invest in research and development have this possibility. And then the next guy's got to do the same thing. And it's all got to grow or the whole system falls apart. Did I go too fast?
No.
Any questions on that? That's a big deal. And it's not been talked about at all in the worker ownership literature. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Just one thing. Also, jobs would come into it to cut costs. You lay off people, so you sort of destroy the whole idea.
Cut salary.
Well, not necessarily, because if you're winning the game, you're expanding jobs. The other guy may lose jobs, but that's a whole different question. That's a large question, but that's not quite the one I'm talking about.
Can you quickly go over why this means that companies have to grow in order to...
Because if you invest in new equipment, and that means you can make them per unit cheaper, then you've got to sell all that stuff. Otherwise, you collapse, and your whole investment collapse. That means you have to market it. That means you have to sell more and more. The whole name of the game is to sell more and more for everybody, which is what means by growth. They have to grow. They're pushing growth all the time because that's how they survive. That's the market system with diminishing returns. Yep.
Is it possible to approach it more from accountancy and changing the rules of accountancy and changing tax laws?
No.
To define the incentives differently?
No. And the reason
you don't think
is,
that'll make it.
I mean, we'll go back and forth, but my argument would be no, for the reasons I'm talking about, because these guys have a reason to do this, and they control the action institutionally. Maybe. I mean, you can't. I'm giving you the structure of power. Your idea is, wouldn't it be great if we just passed a new tax law? And I'm suggesting that the institutional substructure is going to dominate how that tax law gets written. Take a look right now at how the corporations do it, and don't think worker-owned companies are going to be
right. That
much better. Sir?
I was wondering about...
I'm for worker-owned companies. I'm just trying to raise the problem.
Things like the EPA, which is losing traction these days, but in the world you're talking about, we could have longer, more strength in looking at companies, I mean, institutions like EPA.
Okay, I'm arguing against that. Not that you shouldn't do it. I'm arguing that if you don't change the substructure, what EPA will actually end up doing will be subverted in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the argument. So.
Okay, but we are... changing the substructure.
But these guys have an interest in cutting environmental regulations as well. If they're operating in a capitalist competitive sea.
Okay.
That's the argument.
Okay.
That's a question.
Yeah.
What is are all of them upgrading the
system? They do.
Well, if they upgrade the system.
No, what I'm saying is if they upgrade at the same time, then they have the same competitive situation.
Right, except there's a limited market. There's only so many consumers. So somebody's got to pick Dogleg to get his share, and it, what you're talking about would be wonderful in theory, maybe, but all but impossible.
Bart, do you want to take questions now, or you want to...
On this point, because people don't really understand. In my experience, people don't really have the economics.
The thing is, how you handle this situation, they don't produce enough. Are they produce too much?
I want to come back to that. I'm going to come back to that.
For instance, now, what do you do with the...
I don't want to do it right now. I don't want to do it now, and I don't have time right now. Okay. Sorry, I will come back.
Yes, you say that... companies have to destroy the environment. I don't agree with that, because what pollution is waste. If the companies can find ways to reuse the materials going up in smoke, that's their benefit, because
sure.
there's resources they can gain. I give you a specific example.
I don't disagree with you. There are lots of cases like that.
Rindler Paper Mill was producing paper, and they were giving out the byproduct that the public didn't want. It was this wood sugar that was polluting in water. So what they did was they built a plant to turn this wood sugar into real yeast, the high protein food additive and snack foods. And because of that, they were able to take something that was an eyesore and a pollutant and turn it into a crop with simply a little creative engineering.
Okay, but I need to say that you guys got to help me. I can stop and go into these many problems, or I can carry on with the lecture. Very good questions, but I can't do both. So I don't want to be mean and nasty, you know, but I also have to carry on with the lecture and the discussion if you want to go forward. So this brief answer to your question is that certainly is possible, and they certainly can do that, but it doesn't necessarily deal with the problem I'm talking about. These guys have to grow in many other situations. Sir, on this question.
I just want to sum up my understanding and see if I'm on the right track. What you're saying is any competitive system ends up a zero-sum game. Somebody wins, somebody loses.
That's right.
And you want to get to a non-zero-sum game with a different system.
Yes. But any competitive system has this problem, and particularly with regard to diminishing returns. Because then you can cut the base out from anybody else, and you will have to do it because he might do it to you. And passing a law doesn't do it, because the institutional power base of the politics is these guys. So I'm for workers. That's really nasty, and that's a brutal, brutal question. Okay, listen.
You say you can't pass a law, but I'm not sure that that's...
I'm exaggerating.
Okay.
Well, I am exaggerating.
Here's what I'm suggesting. What if you had an environmental fee for every product that you produce, so that the workers, the consumers were paying the true cost right up front?
No problem. Okay. But that requires you to be able to pass such a law. And I'm trying to get to the point where we understand that there are power bases that's associated with institutions that may or may not let you do what you want to do. There's a lot of things you could do to pass laws. And I'm trying to suggest to you that the systemic problem is deeper. You can't just pass a law.
Well, isn't it in the interest of everybody to preserve the
planet? Maybe yes, but maybe not in the interest of the guys with power. It is in the interest of the United States to be on the environment.
Hey, let him go out of this
speech. It is in the interest of everybody in the United States to clean up the environment. Everybody. And it doesn't happen. Why? Because there's a power base. And it won't go away. Maybe it'd be better. But worker-owned companies have power bases as well. I'm trying to get that point across. Sir.
If I understand what you're saying, is that capitalism really is the undergirding problem. As long as worker-owned or corporate-owned, that the concept of competition within it is destroying what we really want.
And that's a significant, that's an important way to look at it, yes. The market, it's not so much capitalism, it's the market. The market has certain technical requirements, and I'm trying to sketch it out from the critique of worker ownership. So. And as I said, it's not just it's cutting costs in this case. And so there are, you know, you can't, I'm exaggerating for some people. You can pass some laws, you can moderate this system. This is the underlying problem that has to be faced in these systems. And it's not whether they're good guys. They have to do it, because the next guy might. So you got a problem with worker ownership. That's, any more on this question?
Do you have a macro end game?
Yes, I do.
That's what the lecture's about.
Yeah. No, I won't get there, because if you don't understand these questions, you can't get there. it's all easy to pass a law, we'll plan everything, it'll be all wonderful. But what about the institutional political economy and emerging government culture?
Yeah.
Okay, so that, you, now you guys, I'm sorry you came in here to this discussion, that's what I'm working on. Okay, yeah, that's it. So we could go at length into this conversation, and it's probably true that for smaller scale it doesn't matter, and there are lots of cases where it doesn't matter, and that's a whole big research problem. Anyone want to do some real research, retired professors? There is no good work on economies of scale. Tell me which firms are too small, too big. Please do that work. Somebody, here you got retired professors. We need to know much more about what you do. So that's another piece. Okay. Now there's another problem associated with worker ownership. I'm a proponent of worker ownership in many cases, but I'm trying to say these systems designed in worker ownership, some of them going back to the Yugoslav model, which had really interesting problems, but also really interesting successes. The other problem about it is, and this is the one very rarely faced, you notice the really big one here is the system, the growth system. And that is really important. I mean, this is a system also, part of the pollution here is climate change. Polluting the air, and climate change is involved in this, and growth, which is resource limits, which is different, is also involved in this. And from the perspective that I mentioned this briefly in passing last night, systems that expand in the world market, like corporate capitalism, become imperial systems. And then they try to, you know, Woodrow Wilson's, I didn't really understand it, but William Atman Williams, a great historian here, was one of my teachers, kept saying, and I finally got what he said. He said, the famous line from Wilson, we're going to make the world safe for democracy. Think about that. Literally, you have, if you're a global system, global markets, you literally must make the world safe, or your system doesn't work. That was the idea. We have to manage the world in a way that, and then post-World War period, we have global open markets. Or we can't work because we're an expanding system.
Isn't this monopoly capitalism?
Expanding system needs markets. And you have to. I don't think this is about good guys and bad guys. There are good guys and bad guys. They must control world markets. Because it's an expanding system. If you close down world markets, you're dead. That's what that's a political economy of imperialism. Read Rosa Luxemburg on this as well. Or Bill Williams. Or Hilferding. I mean, but it drives you to a position that is, for the same reason here, requires you to get those markets managed and stabilized. It ain't just about we want the oil in the Middle East. Yes, we do. They want the oil. Big corporations want the oil. This corporation wants that. This guy wants the oil. But the system requires expansion. That means you got to open those markets to stuff you guys are doing in the Pacific. That's what it's all about from my point of view. And an expanding system doesn't take care of that. You've got to find a system that can be stabilized. How do you stabilize a system? What are the underlying drivers? So I come at, I really enter this discussion from the point of view of imperialism and what are growth systems. This is a growth system. And what are its requirements? And then it produces ideologies. They actually think they're saving democracy. It isn't that they're just after, if you don't understand that they're not just after Buck, presidents and so forth, that they have in their heads that this is necessary to save democracy. It's not there are bad guys. That's where they're coming from. There's an ideology that accompanies that's much more powerful than just bad guys and good guys trying to rip off people around the world. There are those guys. But they actually become convinced of it. And that's a really big problem, that ideologies get generated by these systems. So, I think enough on worker-owned companies.
Yeah.
And then the question from my point of view on worker-owned companies, in which areas does this phenomenon not occur? Small stuff. I mean, David, for instance, likes to say, you know, if you look at hamburgers, they all have the same technology. If you go to McDonald's, they're all the same technology. They're not into having to build and compete. And that's true technologically. Look at advertising. McDonald's controls it. These guys have, there are economies of scale in advertising, and they expand. That's the whole name of the game. So that's brutal. I'm going real fast, but I'm sorry. And I got a little too much coffee, but nonetheless, you get the idea. So, okay, what do you do about that? And there's one other problem that I have to throw on the table right now, which is, and again, I really am encouraging, I see some retired professors, we really need help in this.
Use black.
Black's better.
Black or red.
Okay, what do you do about big ones? really big companies that, because of technologies, have to be much larger than one community. I mean, otherwise, so the one that's most obvious, the two that are simple and obvious, probably, but we don't know about the technology, are airplanes that fly around the world, really big, supersonic airplanes. That's a big company to do that. It's probably not a community scale company. We don't know how big it is. The other one is high-speed rail. So you get an idea that there might be something that requires big scale. And big scale is different because it's much larger than a community. And probably you have to anchor that in something other than a community or a worker-owned company, probably a nation state or a region. So there is the problem. So now we've got units in the next system, okay? Okay, worker-owned companies at a certain small scale. Probably national or something like it, I'm going to argue regional later, for really big ones. And we don't know those scale questions. There's no literature that I know of. But probably there's some big ones, and probably there's some small ones that don't have the problems I just described, and some that are too big to be market that really should be nationalized. So something like that. And then there's a whole range of intermediate ones. Now, here's a second problem about this, and I sort of touched on it, which was, I said it kind of in passing, I should really spend another minute or two on it. Not only do these, in the worker-owned companies or capitalist companies, either one, generate competition, they generate ideologies. This is really great. This is the way to do it. Worker-owned, and they begin, people get caught up in the ideology of what they're doing and saying, this is the answer. So you've got to be careful both if you're interested in designing and working on the next system and having a real debate, a sophisticated kind that advances the ball rather than, hey, I like worker-owned companies, then you have to say, will it generate ideologies that are consistent with your values? Or will it generate systems, whole idea systems that in fact subvert a vision, a real socialist vision or a real communitarian vision or a real democratic vision? And then, so that I touched on the previous, but the next question, and it's really brutal. Got to use black, right? Does it develop a different culture? And people don't want to deal with this. Does it develop, and if you're serious about where we're going, what does it take to develop the preconditions of a different culture that is community in its heart and in its institutional structure that nurtures and generates and re-nurtures and regenerates a culture of common values and we're all in it together? And if you don't, it's not an economic problem, it's not just an ideology problem, it is a cultural problem in practice. And whether the institutions subvert or don't subvert, or nurture or don't subvert, or don't nurture, okay? So the people who have dealt with this, the most interesting people who've dealt with this, are some of the anarcho-communists, some of them, and some of the people who came out of that same tradition, actually, Martin Buber, the Jewish theologian, Pathways in Utopia, and Paul and Percival Goodman, Communitas, and Kropotkin sometimes, and what's the guy's name, the anarcho guy, Murray Bookchin. Some of them began focusing not on the state, so state socialism, and not on worker-owned companies, but on the geographic unit called a specific community as the preliminary element of the system design. Why? Because geographic communities include everybody. Old people, young people, women, kids, people who can't work, everybody is in the game in a geographic community. And if you start with that premise, maybe that's the unit that might help produce a culture that is inclusive of everybody by definition. So that's really a powerful question. I mean, that's a socialist idea writ large. The state includes everybody. But these people are asking institutional questions. And Buber went at it, he ended up with the kibbutz, which is the Israeli cooperative communities, and there's a whole reason why that kibbutz movement's in decline, et cetera. But the notion was, unless you face this somehow, and the democracy, this convention, and particularly the work of the democracy theorists in terms of local democracy, converged with this argument. So it goes like this. Tocqueville or John Stuart Mill or Jay Mansbridge or Benjamin Barber, is his name Benjamin Barber, Elkin, all these people argued from, not from a socialist position, not from a communist position. Marx was playing around with this in the Paris Commune as well. And Marx's discussion, for the Marxists in the room, Marx got into this in a debate over whether the Russian Mir, M-I-R, which was a peasant collective community system, might actually be a precondition of a communist vision coming straight from peasantry. But the notion was communal. In all these cases, the notion is communal as the critical institutional precondition of a culture that might achieve what you want to achieve. That's heavy rep. That's really intense whether or not you could actually do that. Municipal socialists played around with this in the beginning and part of the 20th century. Debs was involved in this. There's a minute that we were talking, somebody was talking yesterday about Milwaukee, municipal socialism, the utilities, land, Milorganite. You guys know what Milorganite is? That Milwaukee was one of the first places to take garbage and sewage and turn it into fertilizer through a socialist institution, and they still do it. They still do it. They actually make fertilizer out of the stuff that comes out of sewage and toilets, and they sell it. So under socialist enterprise. But it begins with the unit of community, whether you call it a municipality, a city, or a commune, or whatever it is. That's the central unit, and it's critical in this judgment for cultural reasons if you can do it. There's been a rediscovery incident in Murray Bookchin's work. Even guys like David Harvey, one of the leading Marxists, has all of a sudden rediscovered old Murray. And he's really worth rediscovering in his later years because he began to work from this basis. Some are the anarcho-communists, as opposed to anarcho-syndicalists, which are more into worker-owned companies, are also playing around with community. And then what happens is they develop a system. Here's what happens. So let's assume you start with this. You may actually be able to build a culture. You communitize all the big institutions other than the little guys that are too small to really bother the system. You communitize them. You municipalize them, if you like. Or in Murray Bookchin's thing, in big cities, you neighborhoodize. I'm sorry, Black. I'll leave you. You neighborhoodize some of the stuff, and then you communitize the big stuff. And the whole goal is to build a different communal structure, culture, etc. Yes.
Can you please give concrete examples? And I mean, I want to understand what are some of those
city,
things
the,
that
the city owns a municipal company. That's a concrete example. It owns a power company. But it might own all kinds of companies in common. I'll give you an example in Cleveland. So in Cleveland, here's what we're working on in Cleveland. In this case, it's the unit. This is like Murray Bookchin, one neighborhood. In Cleveland, right now, that in the neighborhood, 40,000. Average annual income is 18,000. Unemployment, 40%, largely Black. Okay? There are not government institutions. There are quasi-governments, they're nonprofit corporations, hospitals and universities, but the money base is Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth. In that structure, there's a new nonprofit corporation for the neighborhood, which also has on it worker-owned companies that it controls. But the nonprofit is based on building the community as a geographic area, and these guys kick in some profits in the form of the Mondragon model. But in this case, geographic. Mondragon is not geographic. Mondragon is not a geographic model. We can come back to that if you like. It is in the Basque region, but it's not geographic. And then there's a financing model to rebuild the entire community. Now, the Cleveland model is totally inadequate. It's a primitive model, but it is based on the theory that the whole community ought to benefit from economic activity. Yep.
So if you're in Seattle and you have Boeing Corporation, where would that fit?
Well, Boeing is maybe one of these big ones that doesn't fit in this system. We have to come back to it. It's too big.
Okay.
It has to be maybe national or regional. That's why I pulled it aside. Big airplanes. Okay?
Gotcha.
So I'm talking about not those. I want to come back to those. But you get the idea here is based on lodging certain scale in the community in some form. Now, let me give you a sidebar on this because I introduced the second subject, which is really important. I mentioned, you guys are catching, notice in this one, it's really interesting. This system, because these are hospitals and universities with less taxpayer money in them, and they're using purchasing power for these companies. That is a planned economy. This is public money, quasi-public money, Medicare, Medicaid, and it's a very primitive planned economy. It's a sketch, not a real one. But instead of a totally free market, the larger unit, in this case the hospitals, helps stabilize the market for these companies, which otherwise are subject to market pressure. So it's a complex unit where if you get a circular community base and a benefiting, but worker ownership and management, supported in part by a planning system that sustains and helps offset market pressure. That's really interesting. We'll come back, because that begins to deal with some of these other structural problems that we talked about. But that is a different model, but the basic design from our point of view right now, the basic element here is community is the guiding principle of this system, because you need the cultural base. If you want to end up with a system that's going to, that's going to be sustained, you've got to deal with what is the cultural base and what will it produce. Sir?
The cultural base thing is very critical, but the thing it's really dealing with, and it's cultural, is this whole idea of rugged individualism, which is an underpinning of the capitalist competitive system.
Right. Okay.
This rugged, well, and that gets played up in our culture, rugged individuals, yeah, and that's yeah. libertarian and all that stuff.
Well, but that has a culture, that has a institutional base coming out of yeah. free enterprise, small business, right. farms, farmers, and so forth. And the note, now we're talking about a different system, right. the design of which is not individual ownership right. of means of production. Maybe some small scale stuff. But the critical element, I'm just trying to sketch the critical element that is of significance, I think, is the, if you want to get to culture, and this has to do with culture of ecological sustainability, growth, et cetera, and the cultural preconditions of a society, here's a sharp image. A society in which, as a matter of everyday life, people begin to learn the principle of we're all in it together. And that means ecologically, in terms of equality, it means old people, young people, it means democratic process, probably requires geographic institutional base of some kind. Let me say a couple more words about that. I began to talk about it. This intersects with, that's culture. We're going real fast, but anyway, we can't. This intersects with a whole line of theory from democratic theorists, from Tocqueville on, and many, many others, that unless you actually, in your system design, we're not talking about how to get there, although we did some of that last night, and there's a wonderful book to read. In your system design, this is Tocqueville, and John Stuart Mill, and Jane Mansbridge, who's the president of the American Political Science Association, just now, from Harvard, and Ben Barber. Here's the question. If people in their everyday life, where they actually live and work, do not experience themselves as citizens, really as citizens, who actually can make the decision-making work in this process. This is partly cultural, but partly democratic theory. If they don't act, and I don't mean vote. I love this French line that came out of the 1968 thing. How do you conjugate the verb participate? I'm making a friend of mine, participatory democracy. This is a kind of riff on participatory democracy. I don't think participatory democracy gets us this. And I'm for it. Depends how many times you get the word participate. I participate, you participate, we participate, they decide. It better be more than participatory democracy. So let me finish this little bit. So the argument is that unless, as a matter of the institutional design of the next system, unless it actually nurtures and sustains in day-to-day community experience genuine democratic practice, and the institutional economic substructure that nurtures that, you ain't going to have democracy at higher levels because you don't have citizens. You may have voters, but citizens, by which I mean people who actually, not to say aye and yes, yes or no and elect the next king, people who actually propose and dispose and come forward as activist citizens to invent and create the problems that they are asked to choose from. That's a different notion. That's not participatory democracy, though it leans in that direction. That is a full-blooded idea about citizenship. But the critical point from our point of view is it needs a substructure unit in collective unit called a community. So that intersects with the cultural problem. So I'm building up an argument for community. I'm going to narrow it later, but I'm trying to say that this is, this unit begins to become much more important economically, culturally, and in terms of democratic theory. And if that's so, it may be important in terms of the next system design. Sir?
How do you deal with the fact that many of the large urban communities are composed of various other suburbs around the central cities, which whose views may greatly differ, and yet they are also part of the community because the taxes and so forth are many of these people move out of the city so they don't have to pay taxes.
Sure, I absolutely understand. That's a problem transition. We're trying not to stay at the level of theory. We could come back to that, and I won't because I don't have time to. But you're absolutely right to identify the problem. Yeah, Rabban, this stuff, go ahead.
With the, you had mentioned Mondragon and the Basque region, and that's been very successful. Is that in contrast to what's happening with the rest of Spain, which does not work that way?
Yeah, really. How many people know what Mondragon is? Like, she says it the right way. I can't say it the right way. Mondragon. Okay, so with 85,000 people in about 120 co-ops integrated in a very loose structure, it's participatory and like a high tech. Et cetera, et cetera. It's a really interesting model and very important because it's introducing the idea. Yeah. And it is 4% of the Basque economy.
Wow.
Critical. And much less than the Spanish economy. So there's a lot to learn from Mondragon. There's a lot to learn from Mondragon because it is participatory and it's high tech and it's really interesting. And it is currently an expansionary system caught up as any worker control system and worker is a worker-owned system in the global market. And it is up against capitalist competition.
Yes, that's it.
And it is not geographic. It is culturally related to certain parts of the Basque region, but it is worker cooperatives. But it does not partake of these questions of systemic. It is not a system. I'm a fan of lots to learn from Mondragon. We used a lot of it in Cleveland. But really important to understand that it's up against the world market in competitive capitalism. It has nothing to do with planning, has nothing to do with political structure, has nothing to do with how you build a system. It can give us insights, many, about how to do real participatory development. But because there's so many people who've got, you know, entranced with Mondragon, I want to ask you to take a look at it critically from the point of view of system theory. Sir?
Yeah, I have the same problem pronouncing it. But when they went from being the Basque area only, they just opened plants in Mexico, and they're not worker-owned.
That's another problem.
They're just flat, exploiting.
Well, they're trying to change that, and they're not environmental, and they're trying to change that. But the inherent systemic design is worker ownership in a cooperative structure, not communitarian and not socialist. And it's not about changing the system. It's about changing the elements of work. What they're really worried about is jobs for Basque people. But it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I'm trying to give a balanced position. They've done brilliant things. But
and that shows the difference because Spain is really suffering.
Well, it doesn't. It gives you 4% of the Basque economy, and it is very useful. But now they're facing the global economy. Spain is capitalist and has a lot of problems. Capitalism always works out a lot of problems. They've done rather well with what they've done, but it doesn't solve the systemic problem for the large numbers. It's not what they're interested in. They're interested in that institution, and it's really great, but I'm sorry, let me knock it, because people get really rosy-eyed when they go over there. And it's, whoa, because it's very, very impressive. And I think it's great. We're talking about systemic design. It is basically, if anything, it's a syndicalist design. Syndicalist design meaning the design of systems that largely revolve around the worker ownership and build a politics from that. And if you projected Mondragon, which they don't do, they're not interested in systems. They're interested in Mondragon, which is a worker company, basically. But if you projected it, then you'd have a lot of them next to each other, and then the question of how do you mediate the power relationship between these animals. So anyways, but nonetheless, what you got to say? Somebody had a question. Sir? Or, who was it? Was it you?
No, you answered it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
How do we get there?
Well, I don't want to talk about data. No, I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah.
I am happy to talk about it. That's all I think about it. And that's all I write about. But I want to get these systemic design. We have the time available. I want to touch. I'm telling you what I'm thinking about. So I'm really happy to do this discussion because I am really in the middle of this, as you can tell. And I want to get it on the table and then let's fight over it, but I want to get the elements on the table first. Yes?
I have a question. You know, when you talk about building this like sense of community, right? We need that first before we come to this. And
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. You didn't.
I said we do need it. I didn't talk about sequencing. That's a whole other question.
Okay. But at any rate, my thoughts, when you had that joke about citizen.
Right.
I think at the basis of it, when you look at, for instance, our system in many ways and other countries, how do we think of ourselves as human beings? Okay. That's something we all share. In this country, you're an income-generating unit, you're an asset, you're a liability, you're a boss, you're an employee. But we really don't, a lot of our systems, like in the healthcare system, and I see that people do not regard themselves as human beings with a set of rights.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, if we don't get that, we're not going to get anywhere.
That's what we're talking about here. That's what it's addressed in the communitarian stuff. That you must, that's exactly what they're concerned. But not just rights. Rights is a different language. But actually the consciousness of a different kind. And that's what the community stuff's about. So, you know, whether it can be done or not, I'm trying to lay out what the issues are and all this. So now we haven't come back to what do you do about the big guys. And we've talked about worker ownership, and now we're at the community scale. So here's the problem with community stuff. Now, because it's nasty, all right? All these communities float in the capitalist sea right now. We haven't done anything about the capitalist. Somebody asked about macro. Okay, so if you look at Detroit or Cleveland went from 900,000 to 300,000. And you actually take seriously this argument, either John Stuart Mill or again, or quote, communist argument, that you need to have community. Now the question is, how do you stabilize the economic fore underlying the communities, or you're screwed? So let's start with communities. So I just gave you one way to do it. At some level, there has to be an authority capable of stabilizing the market in which the communities flow. We can do it with worker-owned companies at any level. And the reason communities become important is you might generate a politics and an ideology and a culture. Let me say this really carefully. The reason community structures are important, if they can be achieved, is you might generate a politics and a culture and an ideology by virtue of the practice of the community that could begin to generate higher order politics based upon the development at the level of community experience. You might be able to get around worker owners here, private capitalists there, corporations here. You might be able to get both the institutional substructure and the cultural substructure that could sustain a different set of values, what she's talking about there, that could translate into a different politics. Our community, all in and together values. And they might not have to inherently grow. Now we're into imperialism and growth. Problem comes up in either anarchist or other literature or socialist literature or capitalist literature. Here's Detroit, here's Cleveland. Those are cities, communities. How do you actually stabilize the economic basis in a market system? So far we only have a market system, which is necessary to give enough stability or these people are screwed. They have to fight because they lose their jobs. The auto industry collapses. Auto industry collapses, what happens? Technology moves, what happens? So what do you mean? If you're interested in a system, not just a worker-owned company and not just a community, but a system, somehow, and even most of the anarchist communists recognize this, and Bookchin recognizes this, and David Harvey is beginning to recognize this point. You need a planning system. Now, God, the anarchists, they'll die if you say that. But what they call about, they say it's a confederation of communities. Will this work? hey, work. I hope you all shook these down, right?
Yeah, I got them right here.
This is, Picasso. So the anarcho-communists, as opposed to the anarcho-syndicalists, which has to do with worker-owned companies rather than communities as a subunit, the primary unit, here's what they say. Okay, we will. It does require to do that because all these communities, a society is nothing more than a lot of communities. It's an anarcho-communist view. What we'll do is build a confederation of these in order to stabilize the market. I've left aside Caricon. We'll come back to Caricon if we have time. It's another model, which is a really complex model, and I think not doable, I would argue, though they're too friendly. But what they say is, okay, we will work out a negotiated economic support system that will, through confederation of communities, will thereby stabilize the economic model. We will, instead of screwing each other by trying to sell into each other's market, same problem. If they have to survive, they will have to sell, and then the next guy's going to be dead because he's losing the market. Jane Jacobs, too. If they have to sell to survive, and the only way to do it is to take this guy's market, it's survival or take it, and then this guy goes down. The answer is, how do we work out a deal? And they call it confederation. Now, another way to talk about it is, when you actually look at the planned economic requirements of a deal, it's a national economic plan in support of communities. Now we've got national planning on this model. Very interesting. They don't call it that. But that's what it is in practice. And David Harvey is really interesting because to watch Harvey move on this, because he's coming right out of Marxism, geographic Marxism. He says, he's attacking the anarchists. And there's different, anarchists come in different flavors, but he's talking about the anarchy. There is a movement towards communalism in anarchism in that debate. There's also a group that says, we don't plan it, we don't have any kind of things, whatever happens. But that's not what he's talking about. He says, rightly, about confederations. In order to do what's needed to do here, to solve the problem of markets and competition and so forth, and the deal that has to be cut looks like it is a planning system. In fact, it is a state of some kind. He puts it this way. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it probably is a duck. But it ain't called that. So the goal of which is to provide sufficient economic stability and undermine the pressures to come out of the market against these bobbling communities in order to stabilize them. So now we've got, if you buy this argument, now in some way, if you haven't done anything yet with this, but in some way, you probably have room for even entrepreneurs. I want to mention entrepreneurs in high-tech industry. Almost all serious socialist models now include the role for entrepreneurs, because innovation is very important, and you can't get it from socialist models. So there's, most of them have roles for high-tech, and you let the guys play in the field and let them make some money, but just keep them in a constrained area, and you get innovation. So that's a whole sidebar issue, whether you allow entrepreneurial high-tech development as a private enterprise. But most models not included for that reason. Another piece about this, which I want to introduce. In the more interesting worker-owned models, David Schweiker's one, and there's a guy named Ackerman who's been writing in Jacobin magazine. Y'all want to know about Jacobin, which is interesting. It's a new magazine. It is not, they socialize the ownership. And they also, that's to say, the workers don't get, it's like a big private, big corporations, the corporate capitalists own the company, and the managers run it. But there are incentives to run it, because you make more money, and the managers make more, so you're operating in the market. So in both the Ackerman model and the Schweikert model, basically, you actually do socialize the ownership, nationalize the ownership. And you set it up in the deal so the workers can make, run the game totally, and they make profits out of it, they're in the market, but the ownership profits go back to the just like to a capitalist owner. The managers can make a lot of money, and the workers can make a lot of money, but the whole game is to make money. And the ownership can be socialized. So they want to do that to deal with some of the inequality problem. That's a variation on worker ownership that's being discussed. I want to put it out there. Not just worker ownership. That's socialized ownership, but worker self-management in a market system. So all the same problems occur that we've begun to talk about. So far, in the models that begin to emerge, what you're having is some small entrepreneurs and some room for high-tech in innovation. Socialist model. By the way, the state socialist planning system, the Soviet Union, the new literature says, was for the first two decades after World War II, did better than Western Europe. And most people don't know that, in growth and production. And secondly, in areas where there's no need for new innovation, the planning systems did slightly better than the corporate systems. Really interesting. Where they failed totally was innovation. And they couldn't innovate for the market. They couldn't. Then you need individuals for that. That's at least one of the conclusions of the modern literature on Soviet planning was effective, but not an innovation, so they collapsed ultimately. Yeah?
How does this deal with international companies?
Oh, we aren't there yet.
Okay.
But it's a good question. I mean, the basic answer is if all the units begin to be managed in a new way, you've got a whole different system, but we'll come back to that. So what we've got here on this model, and these are tentative models, is somehow orienting to an inclusive unit called the community in some way as a central unit of the system, allowing for innovation for some small firms, allowing for small worker-owned companies, allowing for worker self-management of companies like the Cleveland model, that is collective or a community-wide model with worker management within it, and some community system, municipal ownership, sewer socialism, public utilities, land ownership, lots of things that utilities can do and are doing, which is city ownership or community ownership. So it's a complex structure, but in this case, the central unit, for cultural reasons, becomes the community, inclusive, and then within it, variation, but also sufficient power to stabilize the market collectively in this model. My own thinking is moving in this direction, obviously. How do you begin to really, if you want to talk about systemic design, pure theory of systemic design, either you face these problems or they get you at the pass. That's when you get down the road, these real problems that we're talking about will undercut what you're trying to do. So systemic design becomes critical. It also becomes critical in talking to people about what you want to do. Why would I want your system? It's Soviet Union? I mean, give me a break. What do you want? Worker ownership is a great idea, but look at, I see all these guys competing with each other, so ripping each other off. I mean, what is it you really want? So these begin to be, I think, the direction of the new debate is going to move increasingly in this area, driven by these are logical problems. These are not abstract ideologies. They are problems. We talk about, the right way to talk about this is, these are architecture problems, systemic design problems. They are not matters of ideology. They are what is workable. What do we know about what might be workable? And then how do we get from here to there if we have, and how do we refine it as we go, and how do we learn more and more about it, and so forth. So let me add one other big problem. The other problem is these big guys, big corporations, maybe Boeing. I don't know which ones. And probably they're so big they need to be nationalized.
Yes.
Or provinces. But there are probably not that many of them. I keep looking for examples. I keep coming up with high-speed trains and Boeing. But I'm not, you know, it's really hard to find examples that technologically require large scale. So that's unknown territory. Yes?
What about defense companies? Martin Marietta, Brown and Jules, those kind of things that they make missiles and...
Well, there's another example if we're going to have that in our system. But that, this is to be looked at. I mean, we understand the category. Then we need to do the research on what's necessary. Yeah, maybe missiles. I don't know. I don't know about missiles. But let's put it
but
on the table.
But those are part of also, you know, like Boeing category?
Yeah, like Boeing. Yeah. We don't know what's in this box, but we know something's in this box.
Apple?
I don't know about Apple. That's a question about Apple. That's high tech. I don't know. So these are really they're technological questions, and they're researchable so far. So now you've got a whole kind of a rough sketch of maybe a system. I want to introduce one other big problem. I'll use this. One other big problem for large polities. So this is really an American problem, but not purely an American problem. We don't actually face how extraordinarily large this system is. And it's really time for the left to face this and for the country to face it. We need to add to this parliamentary systems. I mean, the 200-and-X-year-old Constitution is a creaking system designed to produce and conserve determinism. the whole system is based on expansion. You got a sidebar, because there's a whole political design problem. So let's do a little bit on political design, just very little bit. Madison's idea was very straightforward. He was he was clearly a Marxist. Well, if you read Madison, if you read the Federalist 10, the argument is straightforward. The people who own the property are different from the people who don't own the property. The name of the game is to preserve for the people who own the property. That's right out of Madison. He's not squeamish about it. And that's what those people were, 4% of the system. And the name of the game was, he was broader than that, how we produce some kind of a healthy community. He wasn't interest, he wasn't crass. He wanted to build a community, he had a community ideology within that framework. So that was the name of the game. These guys are going to run it because they know what they're doing. The other people are peasants, they don't know what they're doing, and we got the power. And one of the ways to do it, back to imperialism, if we keep expanding, then they won't gang up on us. But they will be satisfied with their lot if we keep expanding. And it's not crass, it's how do we build a system. And that was his vision. There was a communitarian vision, but he wasn't going to change property. And he knew that property meant you have markets. And if you did that, you're going to have to expand, go west, take over the whole damn thing. And that was the model. He was also smart about this. The reason I introduced Madison is tremendous. It's really interesting in this respect. He was a political theorist. He was trying to work out a system design. We live with it. And the creaky old system that he put together at the constitutional level has got this Congress. I mean, it's really a creaky system designed to block power and to keep race. It's a foolish system, but it has a certain design quality. We get into it, but probably there's a whole political design question here about parliaments, and I don't want to get into that. But if you're serious about it, that's also part of the systemic design question we have to get into. There is another problem here that I do want to get into, and this comes out of Madison. Madison's argument in letters to Jefferson was, if we, you know, Madison's famously started out that when the Federalist Papers and all this was being signed, can you have a democracy in a big system? Previous to that, Montesquieu, the idea was you can only do a little system. And he said, no, we can do a big system because we can keep expanding and we'll solve these problems by growth. So if growth will solve the problem. Get that? The whole Madisonian system is growth will solve the problem of conflict, class conflict. It's really class conflict. And secondly, if you spread them out, they can't get together and group, take it away. That's Madison. And we can also build a community on that. It will work. He had a vision. He also writes in his letters to Jefferson, and he was really clear about this. If it got too big, it would become an imperialist tyrannical system. If it was too small, it wouldn't work. It had to be sort of in the middle. We call it a mean, M-E-A-N, system. Otherwise, the tyrants at the middle, at the end would be so, the center would be so strong they could control the peasants. That's the American system. This was at a time when there were four million people sprinkled along the eastern seaboard. And the system then kept moving and expanding. So we're in a Madisonian nightmare. But if you really want to get into systemic design, can you do it in a continent? It's too big, probably. We're at, 318 million? We're going to move to 500 million almost certainly. The high Census Bureau projection is 1.1 billion. High projection. We don't want to get that far by the end of the century. Probably a unit smaller than a continent and larger than a state is the intermediate scale unit. That would probably make sense for governance and model of a democratic system, probably. There's very little developed on this, except in some federalism literature on federalism and confederation. The articles of confederation become very interesting as you begin to look at that. Excuse me. But here's the way to get your head around it. Germany, a highly successful polity, can be dropped into Montana. Those countries with which we often compare ourselves with are minimally regions. They are dinky. I like to say it to my students. They're dinky little European countries. Well, it's a way to dramatize that we are living in an empire. And it's very hard to have a democratic control of anything in the empire. In a scale, the continental system of almost 3,000 miles is not like these little European countries that are much, much, you put France into Texas. France is bigger than Germany. But we're not talking about the really successful corporatist states like the Netherlands and Belgium and Sweden, and which you can drop into little Rhode Island, maybe. Truly. So probably the issue of scale means a regional structure to handle the planning problems of a communitarian worker ownership system, confederated in some way for larger structures, probably. This whole political theory problem that people just beginning to poke around with. So, what else can I throw on the table? Drive you guys crazy by myself. I think, if the other people, here's the other piece of this. This is where it gets interesting. Because if you can begin to build, and building in this direction becomes, if so, this is the direction you want to build towards. There are lots of pieces to this puzzle. The really interesting thing is this. I mentioned last night a throwaway line. We are now at, for family four. We do not, I'd like to say it this way, we do not have an economic problem in the United States. We have a political problem managing the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. This economy produces 200,000 per family of four right now, with all the junk and miscellaneous. That's what we're doing. If the technology and the resource base, both of which are questions, big enough, because we may be running into limits and so forth, we don't know about this, but if we produce the trend line of the 20th century for the 21st century, and remember, this is had two world wars, lots of other wars, massive collapse, lots of stagnation, wasn't a great century. If we produce that trend line economically wasn't a great trend. By the end of the century, it will be 1 million for every family four. Inflation will be much higher, but in real terms, in today's dollars, that's what it will be. Or a 20-hour week and 500,000, or a 10-hour week and 250,000. Now, or that's what the technology so far has allowed. It is extraordinary. Now, there are people who are really questioning whether technology will produce that trend. But that's the underlying potential, and it's a cut in half. Or there is an extraordinary, if that's true, or even partly true, and even today you could have 100,000 per family of four in a 20-hour week. Today, for everybody. There's a whole new realm of democracy that becomes possible because people have time. So that's a whole other thing. Technology and time become really critical elements in the systemic possibility that begins to open up. You know, that's the realm of freedom. Some people on the side, there's a sidebar issue, guys like Paul Goodman, who everybody should read Paul Goodman, bring it back, had argued, you know, people should have at least half their job in whatever the system is. He used to think of the post office, nice socialist system. And then the rest of the time is free. So yeah, you've got to contribute to the whole, but you're also have an anarchist part. I mean, there's all variations on it. That was the Goodman variation on this. So what else have we got to cover? What else have we got to cover? Yeah, questions about this? Yeah.
I just want to say about the regional, that I've heard it suggested that maybe by huge watersheds, maybe break up the continent in terms of watersheds for the ecological reasons.
Well. Yeah, or eco-regions.
Right.
I'm not sure about that. There is a whole eco-region concept, but it doesn't often face political economy problems. There may or may not be an overlap, and it may all not work out quite right. So yeah, it's really important to notice that the ecological discussion has opened up regionalism, but it is also not necessarily coherent with this form of regionalism. And so there's a big discussion that has to sort that out. However, New England is kind of an interesting, you want to think about regions, New England and the upper Northwest are the logical candidates. The other one, you're going to love
let
this.
Let the South, you see?
Let the South. Well, Texas. Read Rick, what's the guy's name?
Rick Perry.
Rick Perry's book on the 10th Amendment. It's a very good book. I mean, it's written by some scholar. That's his end. So I don't knock him for that. But this guy's really smart. It's a really serious looking at the 10th Amendment and the rights of states. And it would not surprise me if, whether they succeed or not, they began pushing this, and that is a region. California is also a region potentially in the next system. So if you want to think about regional breakups, Texas, California, New England, and Upper Northwest are open candidates for beginning to move in this direction. And if you want to think about regions, the system already allows, what is the term, between states?
Interesting.
No, there's a compact. It's constituted in 200 or 300 of them for riverbeds and so forth that states work out deals. They're not national and they're not state. They're federal, they're regional. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Let's go.
Okay. So you were talking about communities. In my mind, translates to towns or neighborhoods.
Not bad.
And so what is there an overlap with social psychology on the unit size of collections of people that is optimum for producing cultural change?
Great. That's now you see that. But I love that question. No, because you want to play this game, then we really have to get a lot smarter than we are. We need knowledge, and that's a kind of researchable question. We really need to get this beyond raving socialists and raving anarchists and raving worker ownership and maybe to say, well, what makes sense? What can we learn from what we know? Really, it's time, and there's a lot of retired professors. Get at it. Thank you for that. So I don't know the answer, but yes, there probably is a lot to learn from those studies and cultural studies. Number two, whoever wrote that. Thank you for that. That's really, you guys, you know, I mean
we're not as dumb as we look. We're not as dumb as we look.
It's not about dumb. You guys want to make a contribution? You got time on your hands? You got smarts? This is a game to get into because we need it. Otherwise, it's all rhetoric and bullshit.
Yeah.
It's got to be rich and developed and designed. And maybe don't like the sketch I'm giving you. We need to get beyond, oh, hey, mine is your better than yours, and looky here, wow.
Yeah, I just got a little bit lost when we were talking about the sort of regional communities. And you were talking about maybe like the anarcho-communistic vision of like confederating that together to like create an economic base. I was confused about whether you were saying there was some sort of like inherent problem with that, or what some of the inherent problems are with confederating groups at that level.
Yeah, that's good. That's a really good question because I went over that too fast. So what I was saying is, supposing you for the moment, we're going to have a communist system, anarcho, whatever, it makes up worker ownership and so forth. Unless you stabilize the market underneath these communities, they will be back into fighting with each other. So that means that there must be some form of planned arrangement between them economically. And that means that involves allocation of capital, allocation of some markets, allocation of services. That means, let me translate it into an example here. Suppose we decided as a community, nationally or regionally, that we wanted high-speed rail. So then we would decide that as a community, and then where are you going to make them? Well, we could maybe make them in this community and thereby stabilize the economy of that community. So it becomes, that's a national economic plan, mini one. So you need something like that, or we sell this and you sell that, maybe how do we work out a deal so we don't cut each other's market? That becomes a plan. And as soon as you elaborate, it becomes a plan. So, but this plan is in the nature of supporting communities. I'm sketching. Did that help?
Yeah. So you're just saying that we do need some sort of, national or like large.
Yeah, and it turns out when you look at that, it's a planning system of some kind, also with markets within. So it's a complex system which uses some planning and some markets.
To quickly follow up, if you're talking about like that, whatever your unit size is that you're working with, don't you think that those units are going to have to all interact in that same way?
Yeah, that's the whole idea.
And so, like, you, at some point, you need a global planning.
Oh, we move out to the global. Let's get one straight first. Let's work here first, and then yes, absolutely, you can begin to if you buy this argument. But we haven't refined the argument. But if we move in this direction, if this is the direction, or something like this, we're just sketching right now, then these questions immediately, what's the global system? Because we haven't talked about trade. You've entered free trade and this, you destroy the system. It has to be a planned trade system. So we haven't even talked about that yet. And then it means how do you negotiate trade between such. By Schweiker's very interesting on that, by the way. And look at Schweiker's trade system, because he said balanced trade. And if you look at a book that I did with a guy named Thad Williamson, but you find my name on it, Making a Place for Community, look at the trade pattern we try to work out to deal with this, where it's based on community. Okay, yeah.
Interruption. The next session that begins at 11 o'clock, there's a PowerPoint presentation on that very question. What a new model, what he's talking about.
Good. Good. Thank you. I don't have to do any more work. Ellen, no, the whole banking system, you too, right?
Okay. Yeah, actually, I'm sure you have a turn. Sorry, but you said it. So I think you can stabilize the funding with a public bank, and it doesn't have to be federal, it could be state, county, city. And I'm actually doing a PowerPoint on that at 11 on Sunday, and he said for them to come to my thing, but it's not in the program, so that's why I wanted to know.
Okay, yeah. So this is Ellen Brager. Ellen Brown is public banking, and she knows more about banking than anybody. I'm not so sure I agree with you about what you just said. We have to have a conversation now.
If it's not in the program, can we hear again?
Where is it?
When is it?
Right here. At 11 on Sunday.
Okay, great. Did I skip over somebody? Okay, five?
Anybody doing any writing or thinking about, in other words, what choices we make for goods that are produced? In terms of based on ecological considerations, in other words, I look around, shark fin soup, for example, in my world, we wouldn't have it, okay?
Correct.
As an example. So in terms of building models, in terms of getting people to participate in their community, as it were, choices, I mean, we need food, we need housing, right. We need education, we need healthcare, we need clothing. Those are some needs.
Right.
How do we structure?
That's great.
Is anybody talking about how we bring these these arguments to the board?
Well, that's really, really important. I'm really glad you raised it. I want to remind me when I finish answering them. Tell me what I think. And remind me to talk about efficiency too. So here, I had a long discussion with a guy named Richard Smith, who's a really interesting guy. He's a socialist, and he's really concerned about ecological growth. And he points out, a socialist system is the only one that can control growth. That's his argument, because capitalist systems have to grow, and that's and he makes it as a direct attack on all the cultural and ecological kind of cute stuff. Different community supported agriculture, little ecological projects. There's a whole thing going on amongst quote socialists, sort of scoffing at the environmental stuff. It's a little Mickey Mouse. It's kind of small, kind of cute. And that's an important thing. So he said the only way you can do it is you have a system that doesn't have to grow yet, and that system is inherently a socialist system, not based on capitalist growth principles. Probably right. That's part of this argument. But notice that the socialist system we know anything about grew. Because there were other incentives to grow. Building more power for themselves, building more, catching up with the capitalist, high technology, making a better life for people technologically. So their planning system didn't have to grow. It wasn't based on market capitalist profits. But it did grow horribly, and it's ecologically disastrous. So if you think a planning system alone will do it, or an institutional system alone will do it without a change in culture, you're crazy. So one of the things about a community system really opens space for all the little projects that are critical to changing the environmental culture. So from my point of view, it's a both-and argument rather than this argument that one system is solved. The culture issue here is again important, and the only way that can be done is a lot of role for initiative. Yeah.
Well, and just to follow up quickly, you mentioned, did you mention the participatory budgeting as a problem?
No, we didn't, but that would be part of it.
Okay.
Okay, because I thought you were dissing it before.
No,
okay.
No. Participatory budgeting is planning.
Okay, yeah.
That's a planning system.
Developing a cultural relationship to...
Absolutely, I'm sorry, I didn't get into participatory budgeting as a move in the direction of this. But I do want to highlight this cultural question environmentally. That means a lot of small... Without a change in the environmental culture at the level of ordinary experience, this system is not going to do that. Really important. So the model has to, in my view, has to include that as part of the community culture, or you end up with bureaucrats kind of, let's make more. So I'm going to say about efficiency. Planned systems, all systems have inefficiencies. A planning system will not be perfectly efficient. This is very heavy to me. Corporate capitalist systems are not efficient. They destroy. Think about this. You take a city like Detroit with 1 million people, it's now 300,000. You threw away the whole city. All the capital, the housing, the roads, the hospitals, the schools. You literally threw it away. And you had to build it someplace else. Because there's people. All those people are left. Capitalism is extremely inefficient. But you need to face up front that if you want to support certain cultural issues in planning, it will have inefficiencies of certain kinds. In some ways, market competition does produce some efficiencies in the narrow sense. Sometimes it does. Competition has been incorrect. Marx was right about this. Corporate capitalism is really powerful. And it does also produce macro inefficiencies. Unemployed people, it was kind of terribly wasteful. I mean, quite apart from the human cost. So it's really important to say, hey, that planning system might be inefficient. Okay. Maybe so. What do we get for it? Maybe we get a culture. But we need the culture, so we'll take some of the inefficiency. Not to duck the question of inefficiency and efficiency is part of the game. And it's up for grabs. Sir.
You have presented a very compelling model. This new economic
design. This is a sketch.
To the extent that it is, through your lens, this is sort of a follow-up to the first comment. Are there others in the fields or disciplines of sociology and anthropology who are thinking of similar sorts?
The models, I've given you the realm of models. I haven't talked much about paradigm. We just don't have time. If there's time at the end of the questions. There is just beginning to be a discussion. I'm trying to put together a project on this, really trying to encourage people in system design. But I've kind of given you the outlines of what's out there so far. There's the worker ownership models. There's the kind of Mondragon thing. There's Paracon. There is a little bit of anarcho-communist, and there's state socialism. So that's so much. That's roughly what's out there so far. And I'm trying to encourage much more sophisticated debate. Yep. Are we going to the right? Did I skip anybody? Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, you have.
What's that? Are you the next number?
I don't know.
What was the last number?
I think you're number four one yet?
I'm five originally.
Five, so. Okay, number five.
I agree.
Did I?
Yeah.
What was your number? What was your number?
I don't know.
Well, you've asked a number of questions. Let's have someone, and we'll come back to it.
I agree that. And the focus on locality is critical to build a democratic culture.
Right.
And there's a lot of challenges with it, and you'd have to have a confederation and so on. You haven't said much about maybe an even deeper level, because I think when you're talking about democratic culture, you're talking about a process of decision-making that people engage in collectively. But we have a really fractured society socially, and the world is globally fractured socially. There's huge inequities right here in Madison, let alone in the country and globally. And with those inequities, even in a locality, it's very difficult, maybe, who knows how possible it is, to generally begin to build democratic culture. So what is your thinking about social inequities and divisions that, to me, would have to be addressed if you're going to have a genuine democratic culture?
Yes, the answer is what you got now ain't so pretty. Okay, we all agree on that. And my argument is that if we're actually to transition towards this, anything like it, there are a whole series of interventions which are critical, some of which are confrontational to back them off. Some of them are traditional liberal to try to raise inequity questions of poverty, but whatever we can get, I'll take. And some of them, critically, are introducing, I mean, the whole point of this book is showing Americans that we already do a lot of, the heart of, Marx was right, and so was Madison. The heart of the system game is who gets to own the capital. You can take it from Madison or Marx, I don't care. They were right. So unless we democratize the ownership of capital and do it in a decentralized way, building up to whatever, you can't get there, in my opinion. So the period that I see we're in is introducing elements and also consciousness and ideology. Where, that's why I think ideas are important. I do think ideas are important sometimes. That the creation of it. So the struggles that you're talking about over the next three decades are the struggles that we all need to engage in, introducing and building elements and beginning to talk about where it all goes and beginning to try to transform and confront. I am not a utopian. It may be. So as I said last time, maybe it's not possible. And the question becomes, how do you move from here to there as best you can? Nonetheless. Number six.
I've seen projects that were just simply stopped in tracks because different communities couldn't work together. A key example, Wausau Area Transit Authority was supposed to include the Wausau area, but it didn't. Here's why. You had various communities who were supposed to help with the bus service who didn't. The reason for that is different communities couldn't get together. They couldn't agree on who's going to how that expense is going to be shared, who's going to pay what. And as long as you have cities and villages and different townships, like you have the Kingdom of Wausau and the municipality or the Duchy of Schofield and the province of, say, like Weston, they can't get on the same page. So what happens, people are being held hostage. People want a bus service to get to Target, Walmart, and various places that they otherwise couldn't get. And they include people who are elderly, people who are blind, various forms of handicapped people. And they're left out of the process simply because the bureaucrats are too busy squabbling to agree on a common goal.
He's absolutely right. This is a problem of any system. It is not solved, however, it is not solved by the current system, and it's not solved by state socialism. There is either you can develop a culture and a common culture that begins to build a base culturally as well as politically, or you do get what he's talking about, duchies playing off against each other. He's absolutely right. So this is not an answer unless you're actually thinking about how you build the vision of we're all in it together. And then the question is whether or not the units, not unlike current units, which are the suburbs versus the cities and versus the central city, et cetera, begin to actually generate all that ideology. Ideology is important. I knocked it earlier. But ideas and ideology become important if we begin also to have a vision of the concrete systemic design. So it's raising a real problem with anything that's like this. Sir?
Number seven.
Seems to me that the Amish culture has addressed a whole lot of this.
Yeah.
Can you make any comments on that?
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes we may find some insights from some of the religious cultures and the Amish cultures. That's a good point. We may learn something from that.
There was a number seven. Is there a number seven? There was a number eight also here. Go ahead, Ryan.
Okay. Yeah, go back. How are we doing on time?
5 minutes, I'd say.
Yes. I'm very much for the state right, like Rick Perry, except the first question I have, why he owns the oil wells that belongs to the people of state. How can we go after those people who owns the state natural resources and get them back for the people of the state? How can we do that? I mean, this is another approach going to make state kind of giving them some rights. And my first approach would be, how do we nationalize the state resources for the people who live in that state?
I like the cut of you, Jim. Obviously, that's a political question which you're all going to have to debate. I don't have that magic answer. I'm not talking about sustainable design, but that's a political part of the game. If you want to play this game, you got to put down decades. Decades either way, even if you change it tomorrow, you still have all these problems. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, you'd have the same problems we're talking about. So the question of the transition, if there is a transition, is to build as much as you can on all the fronts that we're talking about, with a clear theory, too, of where you're trying to go. So, it may be that nothing's possible. We don't know the answer to that. So people in the room who want to play the game, you're hoping that we can, by common effort. Revolutions are also common in history. So are we attempting to move in a direction that is intelligent, wise, and thought we thought enough about it, done the research? We've got to do that, and then we commit. There is no answer other than go forward. But you're trying to do it intelligently.
You have two last questions only. I'm sorry. They're over here and here. Why don't you just both give your questions, and Gar, you can wrap up after with those two questions.
Given the immense influence of religious and spiritual values on individual and collective choices, how do you deal with the immense range of such beliefs and values in this building culture and community?
Well, wait, Gar, let's hear the other question, and you can wrap up with the answer to both.
You made a comment earlier. You talked about the communities float on in the sea of, and you put those little lines underneath those community circles. So the communities float on the sea of, what was the word?
I probably thought market capitalist theory, unless you
economic phrase.
Okay, so my question about that is that it appears over the last 5 years since the massive market crash in Wall Street, that Wall Street's have been hands off by Capitol Hill and the Obama administration, pretty much, with the attitude of, if we mess with that, everything's going to collapse, and we have to support that at all state that the that what's good for Wall Street is good for Main Street. And I feel like we're just being siphoned at the Main Street level, and Wall Street's being overprotected. So do you have any comments on that?
So on the spiritual, there is, I think, a lot in the spiritual tradition, religious traditions, that could cohere with this. I mean, this new pope is really interesting. On this subject, not on feminism, but on this subject, he's really interesting.
What was?
Pope. The new pope is really interesting in all this stuff.
Poverty
and Catholic social thought is really interesting in all this. And he's interested in reviving it. So there is, it's really, you see, what God changes in the popes. Wow. I mean, this is really a different guy. On other stuff, he's traditional. So there's a lot to draw on in the religious tradition, which is communeness. This is the other thing. There is an argument by some Marxists that if you actually look at what Marx is doing, it's essentially right out of the Old Testament. Yeah. The value system of communism that Marx is drawing on is essentially that. You're talking about a current problem. I mean, that is absolutely right. That these guys are not—they are destroying Main Street, and they don't give a damn about Main Street. They want to suck as much as they can out of it. So that's a whole problem of struggle and rebuilding from the bottom up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is addressed in the wonderful book, which you must get. But that's how do we introduce elements that if you like something like this, and then rip it apart, what you ought to do, here's my suggestion to everybody, rip it apart and start again. Do your own if you don't like it. But deal with these questions, structure, dynamics, scale, market, planning, evolution, evolutionary, and then begin also to see whether you can get a transitional strategy. Bottom last thing I'll say, this is like a quadratic, if you want to play, it's like a quadratic equation for mathematicians. What is your assessment of the emerging context? What will it permit? What won't it permit? Perhaps. What is the vision of where you might want to go, and what are the transitional steps? And do they cohere? Are you moving? And this is a kind of sketch of where I think there's enough in this kind of discussion where we could actually have a genuine discussion that would get us someplace that beyond these sketches. And so my urging, what I think, it's time for us to move the whole discussion to a whole different level of debate beyond rhetoric to what is sensible, what would work, what's important, and then how do we get from A to B?
About 15 minutes before the next session, Mara said last night, think of yourselves as historical actors. I think what you saw here is the beginning of a very important, potentially historical shift. So a lot of work ahead, but it's a very important beginning. We're going to follow this with the next session at 11 a.m. Lilia Franton and Herb Edwards on kind of building on this, visioning the next step of society and how, what step you take now. I want to alert you to, I want you to alert to a Friday night economic democracy plenary that'll be held down the street just across from the Capitol. It's in the program. It's going to include people like Ellen Brown, who's public banking, Jackie Dunn on remaking money. The Occupy Money Cooperative, Justin Weeds will be there. It'll be a really great event on the overall economic democracy issue for the rest of the different sessions. So that's Friday at 6 p.m. So I'll be taking that. It'll be on the schedule. You can pick up around outside here and downstairs. So please come back and listen to the next session. And they'll be, we're videotaping all this. And so it'll be on our website, itsoureconomy.us. We'll be summarizing all the sessions as well there. So itsoureconomy.us for video and summaries. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.